Good morning.
Morning.
Now, I'd like to make a special note to the youth who noticed that I forgot my notes and left out and figured that they might shorten the sermon and everything by locking me out. But I will also note I do have a key to the church. Somebody had set the deadbolt. So it would seem like a Murphy's Law. I get home and the printer, not only had I forgotten to grab it, but it had run out of paper. So then I had to put more paper in, and then it didn't have page 5. Page 6 is a bit short. It didn't have page 5 on it, so I had to go with that. And then I get to the door, and I'm ready to sneak through because I hear you singing. I figure perhaps you could have had a song service without me, but there's a good chance that you started late, and I'm okay. And then the door was locked. So I know somebody was up to it. Probably was actually an adult, right? Uh-huh. So, the name of my sermon is Providence in the Form of a Woman, which should, for those biblically adept, narrow it down pretty quickly to who I might be talking about. But we'll lead off with this. What is everybody's favorite book of the Bible? Now, maybe somebody just likes the old Bible, but I think we all kind of have a book that means the most to us, or we find most interesting. Like, I would argue probably not a whole bunch of people can raise their hands and say it's Numbers. Right? Because it's so much fun doing that. Or the Leviticus. There are parts of it that are okay, but you're not going to go through. But there's some book that really speaks to you. What are some of the ones out there? James. That's an interesting one. I wouldn't have thought that, but I like that one too. Psalms. Philippians. They're like, you're all weird. I'm just kidding. No, it's great getting some other ones. Any other ones? Romans. That's very studious of you. Esther, you had to break it because I was going to say, see, my favorite is John, but Esther is what I'm going to be talking about, the book of Esther, and I wouldn't have expected anybody to say that unless you were cheating. Were you cheating? Like I said, you're all really weird. There's no question.
We try, thank you.
The fact is, the book of Esther is not usually on somebody's favorite list. Yet, it's almost a perfect book by today's standards, right? It's got a great plot, it's got intrigue, surprise, twists, evil villains, money, a very sexy woman, I assume, since she knocked out all the other women in the society. Yet, as a whole, people would not choose Esther. Now, for those not familiar with the story, I'll try to do it quickly. Who's Xerxes? And I'm using that form of the thing because I wasn't going to try to pronounce the other one. Can you pronounce the version of his name that begins with an A? It didn't come back. Yeah, so we'll go with Xerxes, right? So you got King Xerxes, and then who's the bad queen? Bad queen. Vashti, right? Vashti. And the reason I like Esther is because it tells women that when their men call, you better show up, right? Okay, that's not why I like Esther. But so what happens is the king has this great party. You know, during it he decides to call his queen in to show her off, and she refuses to come. Now, to be honest, I think he was a bit of a wimp and probably would not have gotten. But the men got worried because if the queen won't come when the king calls, then throughout all of his kingdom, the women won't come if their men call, and who knows, next thing they might be working outside of the home and might become professors and stuff, and that would be a real mess, wouldn't it, Winslow? So either way, he says, no, that's it, she's no longer queen, based on the advice of his wise counselors, and they go looking for the prettiest woman in the whole kingdom, and lo and behold, it turns out that the prettiest one is Esther. Now, there obviously were other things about her that were appealing, even his eunuchs. Might I mention a job that I never want to have? Should there be official U.S. eunuchs or whatever for President Obama? But the eunuchs took favor to her and stuff like that, so there's a bit more plan on it, but she is the cutest. She has a cousin. What's her cousin's name? Mordecai, because you would think it was an uncle, the way he treated her, but it wasn't. He was a cousin, and he had been taking care of her, so I assume he was older. But Mordecai is definitely a distinguished person, has a great ability to give good advice, and actually cares about the king, too. And so Mordecai learns of a plot, the plot's undone, whatever. Mordecai doesn't get much credit for it. And then enters the bad guy. Haman? How would you say it?
Haman.
Pronunciation is never... You see, they tell you in grade school that this is how you pronounce words, right? Because if there's only one consonant, then it's supposed to be a long one, right? So it should be Haman, shouldn't it?
Look.
English Bible, not Hebrew Bible. So either way, so I have to always ask people. So Haman, we'll go with Haman. So Haman comes in. Why is Haman mad? What won't Mordecai do? Mordecai shows a lot of respect for the king, but what won't Mordecai do? He won't bow down to Haman, right? So Haman decides not only is he going to get rid of Mordecai, he's going to get rid of all the Jews. And he, I don't want to say tricks the king, because the king's not... I mean, the king reacted like he was tricked, but the king could care less about the Jews anyway. There's this edict goes out, kill all the Jews. How do they choose the day that they're going to kill all the Jews? Do you remember? They cast lots. That's what Purim means, right? Lots. They cast lots, choose a day, everybody's going to get killed, and ultimately, punchline of the story is that Esther puts her life on the line, because if you go before the king and he doesn't ask you, what's your chance of leaving with your, well, maybe not with your head, but alive? Pretty slim, right? He has got to put out his gold scepter, point it towards you, or you're done. She goes in, another meal later, just like a woman to ask a guy after she feeds him, something he really enjoys. It turns on Haman's head. And the, Michael, what did they build to take care of Mordecai? What did Haman build to take care of Mordecai? A gallows, right. Although it's interesting, the Today's New International Version says it was a pole.
Not true. That's the
answer. Well, it's just a gallows, a pole, whatever Haman built for Mordecai. After that yummy meal, the king felt for a good either skewering or hanging, one of the two, right? Things wrap up. Mordecai and Esther send out a note to all the... Well, the new thing goes out, tells the Jews to kill anybody who try to take them on. They kill like 70,000 or some ridiculously large number. Everything wraps up, happy ending. And ever since then, the Jews have been celebrating Purim, right? So that wasn't a very short version of it. But can you get an idea for those not as familiar with the book how interesting this could be? It would make a, they probably have had a movie of it, but it would really make a great movie. Now, from a theological sense, though, it's a very odd book. John MacArthur notes in his study Bible, which I've got over there. By the way, study Bibles, I do like the English Standard Version. But if I were going to choose a second one, I would go with the John MacArthur study Bible. I don't always agree with him, but it's filled with great information, and as a whole, he's on the mark. Somebody who I can greatly respect. And there are other ones, like the NIV study Bible is really nice. The Today's New International Version study Bible, be a little more cautious about the translation, but the study notes are probably very similar. But I do recommend you get it. Good rule of thumb, though, read the book first, then the notes. Don't read the notes first, because they can actually make it so you read something into it that you wouldn't have otherwise. So what John MacArthur says, the most obvious question raised by Esther comes from the fact that God is nowhere mentioned. As in, what's the other book? There's only one other book where God's not mentioned. One that you also probably won't hear a whole bunch of sermons about. Song of Solomon, exactly. Song of Solomon. Nor does the writer or any participant refer to the law of God, the Levitical sacrifices, worship, or prayer. The skeptic might ask, why would God never be mentioned when the Persian king receives over 175 references? Since God's sovereignty prevailed to save the Jews, why does he not then receive appropriate recognition? So there is no, nada, zero, zip. What other words for zero? Nix, nay, not, right, exactly. No mention of God, and it's in the Bible. And you know, when you look at the canon of how it came, Esther, not as much as some of the other books, but there was some, should it be in the Bible if it doesn't mention God? But before we go into, is God really in there, let's back up a little bit and talk about the book of Esther. Who wrote it? Who wrote Esther? Did Esther write Esther? That'd be the easiest thing. What? It's unknown. Exactly. There are some favorite suggestions. Do you know a couple?
Some think it was Joshua.
Joshua? Mordecai. Some think it might be Mordecai. The book actually talks about him sending out the things. Nehemiah, maybe?
Maybe Ezra.
Ezra, exactly. So there's some suggestions, but nobody knows. Yet, just like all Scripture, when you look at canon and the skeptic tries to get you, if you read non-canonical inspired books versus canonical ones, there's a different feeling. Or read the Book of Mormon sometime and then read this. You'll see what I mean. When was it written? Hey, you got your go ahead. Go ahead. When was it written? Right, so it probably sometime in the 5th century, although there are some arguments for as late as, and it's kind of weird going backwards, because it's B.C. going backwards, so as late as, say, 331 B.C. So it's a pretty old book. When you look at what it writes about, it does seem to have good knowledge of it, but it's probably been written at least before the Persian Empire entirely collapsed. Why was it written?
Because it was.
Well, one obvious thing is, you get to the end, it does explain why the Jews are having a massive celebration every year that God never commanded. Right? And for instance, what's another celebration the Jews do every year that God never commanded?
Hanukkah,
right? Exactly. And there is no scripture. Now, the first and second Maccabees are actually very interesting to read. So I do recommend, if you can get a Bible with the Apocrypha in it, you should get it, understanding it's not scripture. But they're good history. And they do still, even in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, it gives you an idea that God's, well, I'm not going to use the word yet, but God was still involved.
Right.
Okay? Now I'm going to give you the word. The book never mentions God. Is he in it? Is God in the book of Esther? Providence. What does providence mean? What's that word mean? What? I'm deaf. Area of vision. No. It means Rhode Island, right? What? I'm sorry. It says beauty. I like that. Well, that actually, providence is very beautiful. What is providence?
From God.
From God. You're narrowing it down. Providence to me is one of those words that I know what it means, but I can't give the definition. I can't even do a poor man's definition. I kind of had to look it up because it's just one of those things. So when somebody says, oh, that was providential, what does that usually mean? Something good happened at a perfect timing.
Somebody outside worked some good for a purpose.
Right. For instance, this is going to sound crazy. It was providential that you didn't have a job.
That's right.
He and I have talked about it. I won't go into all the specifics. But what seemed 5 months ago like a terrible thing to happen, and as each month progressed and he didn't have a job, seemed worse. He probably wouldn't be standing here, or sitting here right now. He's not standing. I'm doing the standing. Sitting here right now if that didn't happen. And how God's hand worked in that, we'll find out exactly in heaven. But it was providential. It basically, providence is God's working for the ultimate good, to me. Now, the dictionary, going from Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, divine guidance or care, God conceived as the power sustaining and guiding human destiny. So, either divine guidance or care, or God conceived as the power sustaining and guiding human destiny. And we're going to use those as a working definition and then turn to Esther chapter 4. Esther chapter 4. I should have cheated and put my thing there. So I'm reading through the Bible in 1 year again. This is the third time that I actually probably will accomplish it. And I read through Esther. So one of the things I'm not used to, which you are, is it was really easy when I was only doing it once a month, because then I knew what I was going to talk about. But now I got to figure, start thinking that, you know, you say, oh, that might make a good sermon. I used to joke about, oh, that'd be a good, you know, reason for a sermon. Now I actually have to take the notes. So let's all turn to Esther chapter 4. And I apologize, I'm going to read a bit just because I think it's important. This, to me, is the crux of Esther. We all there? When Mordecai learned all that had been done, so this is when the decree goes out to kill all the Jews. Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And that's like the king saying, nobody rain on my parade, right? And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. They'd think we were nuts today if we did that, right? But we have reason, sadly, quite often in today's world. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for, here's another one of those things, Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. I forgot to mention that. Not only did he give a great suggestion, but he offered to pay a whole bunch of money if the king did it, right? Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. When Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai, then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman, even his wife, goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come in to the king these 30 days. So it's been 30 days since she was called in. Now this next part becomes very important, especially verse 14. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Let's go back to verse 14 real quick here. Somebody else willing to read that? Verse 14? Chapter 4, verse 14.
For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?
So Mordecai said deliverance for the Jews would come from another place. Who, I should say what, or who, do you think Mordecai was thinking about? The Messiah? Christ? But he was being specific to that time, too. Mordecai was convinced that the Jews weren't all going to die.
Mordecai's faith in God allowed him to believe that God would bring about the perfect no matter what.
Exactly, but he doesn't say God either. But let's talk about it. Is God in there? Wiersbe's expository outlines of the Old Testament says, God's name is nowhere seen in the book. But God's hand is nowhere missing. Actually, he's got an exclamation point. But God's hand is nowhere missing. He is standing somewhere in the shadows, ruling and overruling. As you study the book, note the following evidence of God's providential workings. One, Esther being chosen queen over all the other candidates. Two, Mordecai discovering the plot to kill the king. That has a fun thing too, right? Just when Haman wants to denigrate Mordecai, he's forced by the king to do these great things that he wanted the king to do to him, to the person who had foiled the plot. Three, the casting of lots for the day to destroy the Jews, resulting in a date late in the year, could have been an early one, right? Giving time for Mordecai and Esther to act. Four, the king's welcome to Esther after ignoring her for a month. 5, the king's patience with Esther and permitting her to hold another banquet. So she gets his attention and says, hey, he goes, what do you want? He says, can you come to dinner tomorrow and I'll tell you? Trust me, if you look at history, this king was not a patient man. 6, the king's insomnia that brought to light Mordecai's deeds of kindness. 7, the king's apparent lapse of memory that led him to honor one of the Jews who he had agreed to slay. And 8, the king's deep concern for Esther's welfare when he had a harem to choose from. Is God in the book of Esther?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry?
Absolutely.
Oh, come on. You can do it. Yes, right? Yes. Is God in the book of Esther? Thank you. Thank you. Now, will you do that out front and tell people about God? I see a little more hesitation. So, getting back to a definition of providence, actually, Wiersbe, in his Be Committed, has what I think a better definition. He says, then Dr. Strong, and I think this was in Strong's Systematic Theology, then Dr. Strong added this wonderful sentence, providence is God's attention concentrated everywhere. Providence is God's attention concentrated everywhere. Now, God's providence shows, like in Esther, throughout, but there are some scriptures that are pretty specific about it, where God makes a note of saying, hey, I am in control. For instance, Ephesians 1:11, in him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Daniel 3:5, there's another book with providence working, and there we do see God. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. Nothing fuzzy there. How about Romans 8:28 through 30? Who was the one that liked Romans the best? It was you, right, Warren? Yep, Romans 8:28 through 30. And we know that though for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. By the way, if you question your salvation, that's a good one to look at. Because as soon as he chose you, it was done. Conformed, was it conformed to the image of his Son. I look forward to being more like Jesus, and I've got a lot of way to go. I want to mention one more special case of providence. Acts 26. You want to turn there? Acts 26. And we're going to go, well, I'm not going to read all of them just to save some time, but verses 12 through 18. Paul, you know, Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles. Paul had a bit of a history before then, right? What was he doing? He was persecuting Christians. He was persecuting Christians. So Acts 26, 12 through 18. And in this connection, persecuting Christians, I think he got some kind of letter to throw Christians out of synagogues, I journeyed to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun that shone around me, and those who journeyed with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. And then it goes on from there, and we know he's blinded, doesn't get his vision back for a little while, and then he goes on to become, probably from an evangelical perspective, the greatest apostle ever, right? The Christian church would not have existed. Well, I take that back. God would have come up with somebody else. But based on how God chose, the Christian church would not exist without Paul. What is a goad?
Sharp stick.
Sharp stick, right? You can get various definitions, but...
ESV commentary.
Right. If you had a stubborn animal, right, you might do it. The ox didn't move, right? So basically, it appears that God was saying, I've been prodding you. Why do you keep kicking against it? And so God finally got a goad that was big enough to get Paul's attention, right? What was the goad that Mordecai used with Esther? Because Because if you go back to chapter 4, did Esther say, "Got it, I'll go right to the king"? No. What did she say?
"It's not proper."
I think she was saying, "I don't want to die. I haven't been there for 30 days. Probably means I've fallen out of disfavor with the king. I don't want to die." And what was the goad? So with Paul, the goad was God blinding him, knocking him off his horse, and, you know, I think there was a voice and everything too. What was the goad for Esther? Do you remember?
"Yeah,
he said, look, you can think you're covered here, but not only will you die, we'll be saved, and it'll just be you. You think you're saving yourself. Instead, it's only going to be you, and God will do everybody else." Now, both Paul and Esther are good news for us. Because, tell you what, if you don't kick against God's goads, raise your hand. That's what I thought. We all kick against God's goad. And the Bible, part of the reason I think the Bible shows people's weaknesses so clearly is because it gives us hope, doesn't it? If God could use Esther, who really was selfish at that point, but then grew up, how many times have we done that too? Where we took the selfish choice to begin with, or we had to force ourselves to do what we knew was right. But it gives us hope. And you look at the end of Esther, getting the providence, and as they do in the annotation, 4:14b, and he says, "And who knows whether you, Esther, have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So as we're kicking against the goads, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, we know one thing that we're all called to do. What's that?
Preach the gospel.
We're not going to read it, but if you go to Matthew 28, verses 19 through 20, we are told to go and make disciples and to teach. Don't we all have great things, Becca, that we could shout out front? How many of us are shouting? We're not, and I include myself. It's very easy to get up here and do it, but I sit next to people on the plane all the time. And, you know, part of it is true that I don't feel like I should trap somebody. I always sit on the aisle, you know what I mean? But in the same light, I don't do it near as much. Yet we've been told we should do this. We have a great message, but we kick against the goads. What goads are you kicking against right now? What promptings is God giving you right now? Will you accept God's providence? You didn't want to accept it, right? You had no choice. Will you accept God's providence? Will you be part of God's providence for somebody else? Right? Or are you going to have to be somebody whose God's providence takes out of the way? Like, come on. Thank you.